You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Major changes could be coming tomorrow in the services for people living with mental illness or a developmental disability in our state. Tomorrow, state lawmakers are expected to release their final budget for fiscal year 2017-2018 for the Department of Health and Human Services. That budget will reveal if Republicans have chosen to shift control of mental health funding, which amounts to nearly $2.5 billion in annual Medicaid payments, shift away from public mental health organizations and transfer it to private insurers. For more than a year, there have been many, many discussions about this. The state convened what was called the Section 298 Work Group to come up with recommendations for the legislature. So-called affinity groups were held all across the state to hear ideas and concerns from consumers and their families. Here with us now are two people with a tremendous stake in all of this, parents whose children rely on these mental health services. Robert White is the father of two sons who are on the autism spectrum. He lives in Clarkston. Robert, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And Gail Marsh is mother of an adult daughter who has Down syndrome. She's with us now from Grand Rapids. Hello, Gail.
Hi there.
So glad to have you both with us. Bob, first, tell us about your two boys, your two sons.
Well, you can see the picture. And the reason I think this is important is that Fred, our older son, is 46. So he was diagnosed 43 years ago. So I start out with at least 43 years of experience, my wife and I, in community mental health. And back then, you know, the support system was almost non-existent because we still had institutions. And so there was no playbook. As parents and young parents at that, you sort of developed and tried to work with the system, you know, at every phase. And Michael is 32. And so Michael had the benefit of a better support system, both from an education standpoint and then post-26 even. The reason I think the picture is important is because I include that on the cover of every narrative that I submit to Lansing or to Washington or even locally, because I feel it's so critical to take the emphasis off of, in this case, a line item budget or an actuarial study, and put the focus back on the individuals who are going to be affected by any of the changes we might discuss today.
Gail, tell us about your daughter.
Well, Kayla is 27 years old. She was born with Down syndrome. We have been involved with the system since she turned 18, at which point she receives her SSI, and she moved out when she was about 22 years old. She reached a point like typical teenagers and young adults do, where we realized there was no more that we could offer her in terms of her learning. We recognized that she needed to learn from peers, and she had the same emotional needs for independence that any young adult has. So she has moved into a shared housing arrangement and is supported by staff with Medicaid dollars, and during the day, now that she's no longer in the educational system, she receives work skill funding.
And how has it been for her? What have you seen? How have things developed for her since she moved out?
Oh, she's been wildly successful. She has matured past our expectations. She also has an eating disorder, and through close monitoring by staff, she has been successful in losing over 80 pounds.
And Bob, what about Fred and Michael?
Well, Fred's in a group home, and he's been there for 16 years. And Michael, he lives in his own apartment. It's an independent supported living arrangement, so he gets services for 5 hours a day, 6 days a week. And that helps him in terms of his social integration into the community. He doesn't drive, but he does have a job. He has a paying job, and it really, that's his self-worth, and it really is really important to him.
Big picture question here. Have you been satisfied with the services that your children have gotten over the years?
You know, basically, yes. I think that where our efforts have been focused on how do we improve the current system, because there's no system that's perfect. And you have to continually, I think, reinvent yourselves, because the dynamics of the landscape changes so dramatically, whether it's from the policy side of community mental health, the funding side. I mean, it's just there's so many moving parts to it that on any given day, you don't know what front to advocate on.
Gail Marsh, what's your take?
Well, I would tend to agree with Bob. I think overall, we're satisfied with the current system. Certainly, the system isn't exactly user-friendly. It can be challenging to navigate the system. But I think what makes it work is that it is public. And if there is an issue, I'm able to talk to people. I'm able to have conversations with CEOs of the local CMHs or the regional entities. We're able to have those conversations and develop relationships. There's also accountability. I try to attend every board meeting that I can attend, every public forum that I can attend, so I can stay connected with the system, and that's what helps it work.
As our legislature decides on the future of services for mental health and developmental disabilities and substance use disorders, what concerns you most? I'll start with you, Gail.
Well, I have a lot of concerns. But as I mentioned, I think when we stray away from a public system, we're going to lose that public accountability and the transparency. A private health plan, you know, is not subject to the Open Meetings Act, and they're not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. So there is no public transparency and accountability. I don't know that Meridian or Molina or Priority Health would welcome me to sit in on a board meeting. And I don't think that I would be able to have those types of conversations with administrators and managers in the system. I'm also concerned that physical health care tends to focus on quantity versus quality. You know, we're going to approve supports and services that will keep you alive, but maybe not necessarily help you have a happy and meaningful life.
All those things you talked about, Bob, those really the things that give you a good quality of life.
And I don't know how to capture it. In my mind, I've centered it around social determinants, but they are just as important, if not sometimes more, than the physical is always important. But don't get me wrong. But the social determinants, the quality of life influencers that are out there are just critical to the day to day happiness and maximizing the productivity and the socialization, the integration of our two sons and those like them.
And what other concerns do you have, Bob?
Well, much like Gail, I think that, again, the current system isn't perfect, but at least you have an opportunity to get in front of those that are making the decisions. When we talk about moving the system away from a public entity or quasi-entity system to managed healthcare organizations, I think of it often as a shift from stakeholders to shareholders. And what gets lost in terms of shifting the emphasis of why an MCO that now has responsibility or an HMO for behavioral health, why they exist? Do they exist for profitability, or do they exist for the benefit of maximizing the services that not only our sons and Gail's daughter and others deserve, but it's their civil rights, human rights, and constitutional rights. It's not an elective. So change is I'm not afraid to change. But we embarked on change, and we want to be part of that change. There's a tagline that's out there that you've heard, I'm sure: if it's about us, not without us. So don't make decisions that affect us in our daily lives without our voice being part of the decision-making process.
Certainly, we've seen, as you look across the country, a lot of states have moved toward a system in which mental and physical health services are more integrated. And the health plans, which by most accounts have performed well in handling the physical health services for Medicaid recipients, they're arguing that integration will improve outcomes for people like your children while being more efficient. You're shaking your head.
Well, I get really energized when somebody talks like integration doesn't exist today. We have integrated health today with physical and behavioral. My sons have primary care physicians, and the integration on the behavioral side happens through his supports coordinator, who is a lot closer and knows my two sons intimately because they've been assigned and worked with them for years. So when I hear a legislator or when I hear an executive director representing an HMO or an MCO say, well, don't you agree with treating the body and the mind and the whole person? I get incensed because they almost talk from a standpoint that there's this huge void today. And that's not the case.
Gail, is this integration of mental and physical health care a priority for you?
Well, absolutely, with regard to service delivery. Certainly, we want to see coordinated care, and that is happening. As Bob mentioned, we have coordinated partnerships. There's a lot of new programs, but I think that we've proven that privatization doesn't work. I only need to point to the Veterans Administration disaster, the prison food system disaster.
What have the health plans said to you in terms of what would change?
Well, that's interesting. I think that if I'd heard one of the health plans say, if we transfer the funding of behavioral health over to us from the public entity, here are the benefits that you're going to receive. Why, as a parent, if I read through that list of benefits and improved services, would I ever say, no, I don't want that? But the only two areas that I continue to hear them say is we can save money. There's been a lot of debate about how much they can save. And then certainly there's a lot of questions about how that savings will be reinvested into the services, or will it go to the shareholder or the stock price. And the other thing they say is, well, we're doing it in other states. And look, I've done as much research as I can on this activity in other states, and I beg to differ with them. There is not one feedback that I get from other states that are going down this path of integration of the funding of behavioral health that isn't struggling right now.
Gail, do you share these concerns?
Well, I certainly do, and one of my biggest concerns, I was a member of the Lieutenant Governor's original Section 298 work group. And repeatedly, the primary stakeholders, the consumers and their families, called for a system that ensured the public oversight, the accountability, and the transparency that I've already discussed. Mm-hmm. So, and this was also overwhelmingly supported in over 30 affinity groups of eligible persons and families in Michigan. So I was outraged, if you will, when the legislature this year then proposes pilots that call for the privatization or single contract pilots. I spoke to the House Appropriations Subcommittee a few weeks ago, and in my testimony, I referred to a comment that Senator Shirky was reported to have made. And he said, we've been dancing around the concept of integration far too long, and the legislature needs to force things to happen. And I told him the reason that we've been dancing around total integration for so long is because it's not what people want. And the job that they've been hired to do or elected to do is not to force unwanted things on their constituents, but to listen to the people who elected them. So both the House and the Senate, who are representatives, supposedly, of the people, have dismissed the recommendations of the work group and the stakeholder affinity groups, which were to maintain a public behavioral health care system.
These are your children that are being talked about here.
Yes.
What do you feel about what your the message you're getting from legislators?
Well, I think we feel so disenfranchised by the system that's supposed to be working for us and representing us, you know. And they're not bad people that we're talking about, but
no.
I think that, you know, there's just this strong pull from the party line to cost reductions that it just minimizes the whole voice that we're trying to represent here. And I, like Gail, she was part of the work group, but I facilitated the several affinity group meetings and was encouraged that, boy, they're doing it right. And, you know, they're going out and asking the recipients and the advocates, what do you want? And then to go through that study for that long period of time and have literally the entire executive summary or the recommendation be ignored, it just tells you how dysfunctional, in my opinion, we are in that process.
Well, I think they've already made up their minds about what they want to do, and it angers me to think that this might have been just a smokescreen to give the appearance that the public had any input and that they were going to listen to us.
Bob, what keeps you up at night?
Oh, I've heard this said many ways, but my wife and I are afraid to die because every year we as parents, we're not going to be around to advocate on their behalf. To make the trips to Lansing, to go to the meetings, we have to come up with something that's more sustainable so that we have the confidence that when we're not here, that our two guys, Gail's daughter and others like them, are going to be taken care of.
Gail, how about you?
I echo Bob's sentiments exactly. In fact, I said that to the group of 135 persons at the Section 298 work group. I told them that myself and other families that I'm aware of, you know, we have a confession. We, like Bob, are hoping that that our sons and daughters don't live longer than we do because we can't trust that there's a system that's going to take care of them.
Gail Marsh is the mother of Kayla, who has Down syndrome. Gail was with us today from Grand Rapids. And Bob White, father of Fred and Mike, his sons who are on the autism spectrum. He is from Clarkston. Thanks so much to both of you for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.